Good morning. It's 11 minutes before the hour. You're listening to NPR's Morning Edition over Raven Radio, KCAW in Sitka, where it is 48 degrees and overcast with rain in the forecast today. It's Friday, September 7th, 2012. I'm Robert Woolsey with Raven News. The head of Sitka's Chamber of Commerce will run for school board. Jennifer Robinson declared her intent to be a write-in candidate in the October 2nd municipal election. Robinson has lived in Sitka for 4 years and also is the daughter of mayoral candidate Mim McConnell. Family relationships in Sitka's elected offices are not unprecedented. Mayor Marko Dapcevic presided over an assembly on which his half-brother Dave also served. And if you want to get really technical about things, two school board members have served with family. Molly Kabler and Lon Garrison were both on the board when their high school-age daughters served as student members. Incumbent Cass Pook is the only person who filed a formal candidacy in time and the only name that will appear for school board on the ballot. Robinson's name will need to be written in. The pair are the only ones running for two seats on the board. Longtime school board member Tom Conley will not seek re-election in October. An old idea in philanthropy is getting a new start in Sitka. A reception for anyone interested in learning about forming a community foundation is planned for this evening at Braveheart Volunteers and the Pioneer Home Manager's House. Lily Herwald is a grant writer and a nonprofit consultant. She's been one of a half dozen or so people meeting informally to discuss creating a Sitka community foundation. Herwald says every community has needs in health and social services, the arts, education, that may be better served by a mechanism above and beyond routine charitable giving. That's where a community foundation comes in.
It's really an avenue to give individuals who have the resources a safe place to invest and to have a safe place for their philanthropy that can be targeted toward the things that they care about. And more often than not, philanthropists really want to invest in their local communities.
Philanthropists, in other words, have the big bucks. And what separates philanthropy from charitable giving is scale and structure. A community foundation would be managed by a director and governed by an investment board. Herwald, whose long career in Sitka includes serving as general manager of Raven Radio, says a community foundation can attract and reinvest money that might not ordinarily find its way into nonprofit development.
One of the things with a community foundation is it's not meant to give competition to existing nonprofits and that sort of thing. It's not as if, you know, with the example, say, of Braveheart Volunteers, that the individuals who contribute would suddenly put it into the community foundation. They would still continue to help support that nonprofit. Quite often, community foundations are looking at larger gifts or bequests or estate planning and things like that.
The Rasmussen Foundation is Alaska's largest and most well-known philanthropy. Representatives from Rasmussen will be in Sitka with the Anchorage-based Alaska Community Foundation later this month for a public meeting to discuss the ACF's affiliate program. At tonight's reception at Braveheart, noted Juneau philanthropist Sam Skaggs will give a presentation on the benefits of an independent community foundation. Herwald says the Sitka group has no agenda at the moment but to learn what model might work best here if one is needed at all. In fact, Herwald is perfectly willing to admit that the status quo might suit Sitka just fine. However, philanthropy is a reflection of a community's maturity, its economic and social growth. She thinks Sitka might be ready.
One of the things that's interesting about Alaska and Sitka in particular is that there hasn't been an ingrained level of philanthropy on the larger levels. We have a lot of individuals who are giving to Raven Radio, to Braveheart Volunteers, to the Science Center, you know, to any number of nonprofits. But sometimes the people with more resources are not necessarily going into philanthropy. So how can we help show them that they can make a lasting impact on their community's needs and have a family legacy?
The reception with philanthropist Sam Skaggs will be from 5:30 to 7 p.m. at Braveheart Volunteers this evening. Everyone is welcome. Refreshments and dessert will be served. Southeast seine crews have been swapping their nets for bait sheds as they shift from summer salmon fishing to fall longlining. The fleet's total pink salmon catch was less than a half of last year's, but somewhat higher than projections. It was a good year for summer chum, and prices remained high for both species. Matt Lichtenstein checked in with the Alaska Department of Fish and Game.
The summer seine fishery wrapped up at the end of August when Fish and Game announced there would be no more pink salmon openings this season. Some seiners continue fishing for fall dogs, but pinks are the fleet's bread and butter. Since 2006, the runs have been coming in weak on even years and strong during odd years. 2012 was no exception. Fish and Game projected an all-year harvest of 17 million fish, and it came in roughly 20 million, nearly 19 million of which were caught by the seiners.
So we're a little bit above forecast, but pretty much in line with preseason expectations of a weak even year.
That's biologist Bill Davidson, the department's commercial fisheries coordinator in Southeast. According to Davidson, climate played a big role in the up-down cycle of pink returns.
In Southeast, we had a pattern of strong both even and odd years until 2006. And then in 2006, we had cold winter and cold spring conditions, and combined with sort of a drought during some of the spawning returns, and so those climatic conditions led to, you know, poor early marine survivals and started this cycle, and it seems to be taking some time to recover from it. What makes the pattern persist so long is a little bit beyond my ability to explain.
The biggest pink catches this year were in District 4 on the coast of southern Southeast, where the fleet brought in 6 million. They landed nearly 6 million more from District 2 off the southeast coast of Prince of Wales Island. It was just the opposite last year, when most of the pinks were caught in the northern panhandle. Low pink projections for 2012 meant less participation. 238 boats made landings this summer. That's compared with the 270 boats that caught a whopping 55 million pink salmon last year. According to Davidson, the number of pinks escaping upstream to spawn was good overall this year, but there were still trouble spots.
I think some areas actually took a further downturn, like Peril Strait, Hoonah Sound area, was actually a setback from escapements. 2 years ago, that area never even opened all season, and other areas were quite good, and I think even within areas there were some strong returns right next to some weaker returns, so kind of an inconsistent pattern of escapements.
This year's dock prices were on par with last year's, which were exceptionally good. Pinks averaged around 40 cents a pound, and dogs fetched twice that. Dogs are the other target species for seiners, and Davidson says they landed a total of 5.8 million this summer, 1.2 million of which went towards cost recovery for hatchery operations.
It's not an all-time best or anything like that, but it's a very strong chum return this year, and of course, most of the chum that are harvested in the Southeast purse seine fishery are produced by the hatchery organizations, and almost across the board, the hatchery chum returns were better than the hatchery organizations had forecast.
Along with chum and pink salmon, seiners landed 248,000 coho, 171,000 sockeye, and 38,000 kings this season. Davidson estimates the all-species seine catch was worth a total of roughly $64 million in Southeast this year, which is less than half the value of the record 2011 season. In Petersburg, I'm Matt Lichtenstein.
The Alaska Native Tribal Health Consortium is seeking more participants for the Local Environmental Observer Program, which collects observations from around the state about unusual or extreme environmental occurrences and changes. Since the program began in January, 130 tribal environmental leaders from 85 communities around the state have registered as local environmental observers, who are called LEOs for short. Mike Brubaker runs ANTHC's Center for Climate and Health. He says the LEOs serve as central points for collecting observations from everyone in the community.
In some places in the circumpolar north, changes are happening very rapidly, and its elders have a long-term perspective on what's going on and what's unusual and what's important. But even young people have seen sometimes some pretty amazing changes or observed new occurrences, and they're also engaging in their environment in different ways than the elders are.
Leos are interested in everything from sightings of invasive species, unusual birds, insects, or other wildlife, and changes in wildlife behavior and health to extreme weather events or extreme erosion. The Leos collect the information, then submit it to a central database where they are listed on the program's website. Brubaker explains that forming a communal database helps Leos connect with topic experts.
There was an interesting posting that came from Southeast about hairlessness, or not hairlessness, but loss of hair in deer, and that resulted in some really interesting conversations about the types of causes of hair loss in deer, not only in Alaska and in Southeast, but in BC.
They can also see if there are any larger environmental trends going on, connect affected communities, and raise awareness about different topics.
We think that's really important within the tribal health system because sometimes it results in concerns about water safety or security or food safety and security. We learn things about risk for injury, for example, the seasonality of when falls through ice are occurring.
All of the reports are documented on the program's website. You can click on a map of Alaska, and it will tell you what observations were made in different areas each month. The easiest way to find the site is by Googling Alaska, L-E-O. The Alaska Volcano Observatory has lowered the alert level for an uninhabited Aleutian Islands volcano. The observatory says satellite views of the 5,600-foot Cleveland Mountain, about 940 miles southwest of Anchorage, show no evidence of eruption since an explosion on August 20th. A satellite last detected fresh lava in the summit in early May. Sun weather forecast today for Sitka and PA calls for chance of rain this morning, then rain heavy at times in the afternoon, highs around 54. This is Raven Radio, KCAW in Sitka.